This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, everything is going plant-based, including tires.
And we find out about the other NCAA.
If you see construction in Oshkosh this summer, it's probably not what you think it's for.
And we're going to talk about stupid pilot tricks with consequences.
Finally, David, Aero Friedrichshafen is in the books. It was a good one. We'll go through a couple of the news hits.
Ian, are you ready to do some hangar talk?
Let's do it.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, our guest this week, a really cool woman you actually sat next to on a flight, of all things. And then caught up with, you guys were headed to the same event, a WASP reunion. Erin Miller, she was a driving force in getting those WASPs recognized.
Indeed. And it was all about reinterment at Arlington National Cemetery. The women Air Force service pilots from World War II just wanted the same, I don't want to say freedoms, they wanted the same privileges as other aviators. And Erin was great. She's got two books. And she'll tell us about that. And she was just a fascinating person to hang with. And I want to thank her for being such a good host at the WASP 80th reunion out in Sweetwater, Texas.
Okay, awesome. So we'll talk to her in a few minutes. First, the news. I guess, I said tires are going plant-based. And I suppose you could say they already are plant-based, right, with rubber trees and latex.
Yeah.
However, a lot of those materials are from international sources, tropical sources. And the DOD is looking into new sources, and so we might benefit as well in the GA world. Dave, you'll never guess, the new source is dandelions. They are testing dandelions as a rubber source.
How tasty, Ian. You've had a dandelion salad. When you hold a dandelion up to your chin, you can tell if you like butter or not, if it
right, the yellow,
shines
yeah.
yellow,
yeah, yeah.
right?
Yeah.
We're not talking about yellow shiny stuff. We're talking about really replacing some of that rubber component with a special type of dandelion. And there were 2,500 species of plants tested, and I can't even pronounce the one that took
the one
at the top that was the only one that worked. But it's a species of dandelion known as TK, and it might be an alternative to natural rubber. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it is cool. And I tell you, if it happens, it won't be too soon, because anybody who's replaced aircraft tires recently knows that supply is absolutely an issue. In fact, the episode of Ask the A&Ps that just came out a couple days ago, May 1st, the first question is about a guy who just could not find tires in stock. And so he was asking, can he go to a different ply? And should he go to a different ply? All the hosts talked about the same issues. They've all had tire supply problems. So, yes, this would be a great benefit, I think, to the tire industry, especially because they say it's like it can harvest in 6 months, I think, the dandelion.
Yeah, that looked really enticing to me. And, that's an interesting sustainable future for that product. So I could see, and, perhaps, Ian, and this is just wishful thinking, maybe some airports with excess land might even be able to grow some dandelions and harvest that. And it'd be kind of a really neat recycling thing going on there, huh?
Yeah, that is cool.
So now it's a serious endeavor, though. The Air Force is going to test this out over at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, because some of these plants are going to be in the ground and harvested up in Ohio, and starting with the spring of 2022, which is where we are right now as we record this, the spring of 2022.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so we'll keep our fingers crossed that that works. That's really neat. Okay, moving on. The National, oh boy, here we go. National Collegiate Athletic Association. That's NCAA, right?
Yeah, but we're going to talk about the National Center for the Advancement of Aviation. That's what's confusing to me. It's the other NCAA.
The other NCAA. Yeah. Hopefully this one is a little less controversial. We've talked a little bit about this sort of thing in the past. This is FAA and Congress's push to strengthen the aviation workforce. Specifically, we're talking about a bill that's going through Congress. Right now, it's H.R. 3482. The U.S. House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, the T&I Committee, approved this, and so it is moving along. 200 organizations across aviation have expressed support for it, and there is a companion bill in the Senate, so we're getting there.
Yeah, and look, it has 62 bipartisan co-sponsors, and I think that's significant. The word bipartisan, I think, is significant. Yes. Because a lot of folks recognize that the aviation industry, aviation and aerospace industries, are the wave of the future. And we have a severe pilot mechanic shortage. We've been talking about that for years, you know, to the tune of 600,000 pilots, maybe 625,000 maintenance technicians. And we got to fill those ranks some kind of way.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we talk about some of the other stories on this program later today, we'll learn that there's so much going on in the world of aviation. We just have to have people available to fly and fix the things that we're in.
Yeah. So the idea here is to be sort of a test bed. I think they would develop curriculum. They would hold workshops. They would do training. Yeah. So all in the pursuit of trying to increase that that workforce, strengthen the training programs, the pipelines, that sort of thing. So yeah, we watching this one really closely.
And well, before we move away from that, I was going to just point out to folks who might have a concern about it, is it politically motivated or not? Mm. This is a not-for-profit entity. No general fund taxpayer dollars would be used to support it, but it would instead be financed by those who use our nation's aviation system and contribute to the Airport and Airway Trust Fund. I think that's pretty important to point out. It's mainly private sector contributions, and it would be prohibited from involvement in any political or legislative activity. So sort of standing off away from political allegiances. Just this is for the betterment of aviation and aerospace purely.
Good point. Okay, David. So I want to label this one News of the Weird. AvWeb is reporting that there is, of all things, an eVTOL terminal being planned for Oshkosh. It's been funded. They're talking about breaking ground very soon. So I guess if you want to fly into Oshkosh this summer, potentially in your eVTOL, which, you know, will be no one.
Yeah.
You'll have a place to hang out and charge it.
No one yet. You know, Whitman Regional Airport is getting ready to have an update at the terminal anyway. We reported on that a little while ago. Our e-media team has been all over that. So we're looking at an eVTOL charging facility. So it's one of those things that if you build it, they will come. I think that's what the promoters are thinking about.
Yeah.
And have a charging station ready to go. And I think that this is pretty ambitious. 8 months from now, these vehicles will be available for purchase by anyone anywhere in the world. This is Volatus co-founder Grant Fisk talking about eVTOL aircraft. So, you know, 8 months, that's a pretty robust statement to make. Yeah. But if it happens, there's going to be a charging facility at the world's biggest air show.
Yeah. I would put my money more like on 8 years, but he's
optimistic.
He's an optimistic guy, and I guess that's why he's the one, you know, doing the construction. Yeah, they're talking about $500,000 that they got funding for to be able to do this, which is incredible.
Serious money.
He does make the point, and he's right, that basically when Teslas came out, they came out sort of ahead of the infrastructure.
Yeah, and then how do you charge them unless you're at your house? What do?
Yep.
You can't really go on a trip, right?
Exactly. So they're saying, well, okay, we're not going to be part of that problem. And I commend them for that. But anyway, I actually do hope it's ready for Oshkosh or soon after, because it will be cool to see it. If not this year, maybe next year. Just neat to see what one of these things is going to look like and what their concept is. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
And we'll be right back.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. David.
Keeping our eyes peeled, let's look out for stupid pilot tricks. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
The YouTube is filled with them in the past week or so. It's crazy.
It is amazing. I mean, we see this kind of every once in a while, you know, somebody doing something kind of silly in an airplane or out of it, as the case may be here. But boy, there's been, three maybe in the past week and a half that have kind of hit. One, let's start with the one that actually happened first, but is now we're hearing about the consequences. This is Trevor Jacob. He's a former Olympian. He's the one who bailed out of the Taylor craft, filmed the whole thing, said he had an engine failure, but the airplane was all equipped with cameras. He had a selfie stick when he bailed out, and the FAA didn't take too kindly to this stunt.
No, we'll not it. At all. Yeah. And, you know, people online started tearing this effort apart right from the get-go. If you watch some of the video that Trevor even recorded, you could see him flying over an emergency airfield. He didn't make any effort to restart that airplane. You know, he didn't talk to ATC, declare an emergency, or anything like that. These are all things that we have sort of been trained to do from the get-go by our instructors. Look for an emergency airfield, first of all, best glide, you know, and then, you know, aviate, navigate, and communicate, you know, let people know what's going on. So, and it did not end well that day for his 1940 Taylor craft, and it is not ending well right now for Trevor Jacob.
No. So FAA has sent him a letter for an emergency revocation for careless and reckless, which I guess makes sense. It's, you know, this one seems kind of open and shut. I don't know. There isn't word yet if he's going to appeal it or not. But if you haven't seen the video, I would say go see it, but maybe don't. In fact, I was a little surprised about this. It's only been viewed about 500,000 times. So I know this guy, if this is a stunt, and I think we can assume it is, you know, he's sitting there planning this out and he's like, oh man, this thing's going to get millions of views. It's going to pay for the airplane. It's going to, you know, make his profile that much higher. This, I got to think he thinks this has been a flop. I mean, it has a lot fewer views than I would have expected for a stunt like this. And the feedback obviously has been very negative.
I mean, that was negative from the get-go. He was wearing a sport parachute, and you know, that's unusual. And then some other folks pointed out that when he bailed from the airplane, he had a fire extinguisher tucked inside his lower leg. That was interesting. And a bunch of other inconsistencies. So I don't know. I he's obviously in a lot of trouble right now. The New York Times took it the case to point and started tearing apart his story a little bit, you know. And the FAA determined that he violated FAR 91.13, operating single engine aircraft in a careless or reckless manner so as to endanger the life or property of another.
Yeah. So the next one, which we're all talking about also, and you've probably seen the video, which I don't know that I want to call it a stupid stunt, maybe just poorly managed. This was the plane swap, the Red Bull plane swap. I would say this one, if you haven't seen the video, definitely check it out because it's pretty fascinating. And it's interesting to watch what happens to one of the 182s. But you know the setup. Two 182s, two skydiver pilots. They were going to, in midair, swap airplanes and then land successfully. They were 50% there. So the other, unfortunately, 50% resulted in a wrecked airplane, but a safe pilot, so that's good. I'm curious what you think, David. This, I mean, Red Bull's known for pulling off crazy stuff, but they tend to do it with a lot of planning, I think, behind the scenes that people don't see. And this one, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it.
It's interesting because they're skydiving cousins. So these folks are related, first of all. They're both, you know, pilots, you know, bona fide pilots. So what happened was one of the Cessna 182s looked like to me via video that it entered a flat spin.
Yeah.
The airplanes almost collide also. Yes. I don't know if you saw that part of it.
Did.
That looks scary.
That's scary.
Ian, have you ever been skydiving? I'm going to admit I haven't yet been skydiving.
Once. I went once. It was like once was enough, you know? Did it, been there, done that.
Could you see yourself skydiving into an airplane behind a propeller? I mean, I don't know about this.
I'm with you. That's the one thing about this whole thing. I thought, okay, you know, I know people have free-falled into things, skydiving before. You know, you see them in cars and all kinds of silly stuff. Okay, I get it. It's not my world, and if they want to do that. But yes, I saw the video, and the fact that the prop was still windmilling, I was flabbergasted. It's like, man, if he misses, that's going to hurt.
You're chopped up, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real problem. So the bigger problem for this effort was the fact that the FAA denied, you know, the request to do this. And yet the folks that participating still went on with the show because I think it was all for a Hulu show. It was like a pay-per-view thing.
Yeah.
Almost like back in the day when we were watching Holyfield and Mike Tyson box, you know, it was a pay-per-view thing.
Yeah, it was a big deal. So.
So I don't think the views are worth the risk. That's just my opinion. But clearly they did not pull it off as intended.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, they had modified the airplanes. There was a speed brake, kind of a custom speed brake below to try and moderate the free fall speed. They said there was an autopilot setting that kept it in a dive. You're right. The one airplane did go into an inverted flat spin and essentially like overpitched and then went to a flat spin. I guess, yeah, a couple of things. You know, people are sort of lamenting the loss of the 182, and that's true.
I am, too. I mean, it's hard to find a 182 on the used market. There was a highly modified airplane, though. There was a lot of avionics in there and a lot of electronics to keep that airplane flying with no one in it.
Yeah. In fact, the photo, the still that we have leading the story and that I've seen a lot, you can clearly see there's a 430 in there. And it's like, man, the screen on my 430 is bad. I want that 430. It's like, why couldn't you take that out before you did this?
That's a good point, It's a very nice panel. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. I think this is something in concept. I'm like, done professionally. Okay. I'm all right with it. But you're right. They were denied. And part of that is protecting the airspace because there was an Embry-Riddle airplane that flew right through the middle of this whole thing as it was going on because no one knew what was going on. You know, they didn't. It's like you got to protect the airspace for something like this.
True. And the other thing is that, you know, when you look at stunts like this or the Trevor Jacobs stunt, it really puts a black eye over a lot of general aviation. And that's what I worry about more. You know, we're not so much about risk taking. At least I know I'm not. You're not. The folks I fly with are not.
Yeah.
So this makes it look a little conspicuous from the outside looking in. And we at AOPA, we strive so much to get folks on the straight and narrow and, you know, do the right thing and train and take courses from ASI. And here you are at the opposite extreme, you know, exploring the outer envelope of aviation. And to me, it's just an interesting optic that I'd much rather avoid.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, it's a really good reminder that if you're really into these stories and into maybe some of the consequences, Richard McSpadden, the head of ASI, and then actually Jared Allen, AOPA's deputy general counsel and a pilot, they put together a video that talked about what some of the consequences here are going to be. And so that's a really interesting watch. It's about 15 minutes. So definitely go on the website, check that out. It's worth a view.
Yeah, and they also brought into the mix a little bit of about Trent Palmer, who is a widely known YouTuber who has preached a lot about safety and does a lot of backcountry flying, exploring that backcountry envelope. But he's been a pretty staunch, you know, he staunchly reminds folks that he tries to do this stuff with a lot of foreplanning and pre-flight planning and really analyzing what he's going to do. But he got into a little trouble a couple of years ago. The story's just now coming out, Ian, that he was overflying a friend's property intending to land, but he didn't land because some of the earth had been moved around for a motorcycle track, a little motocross track in the backyard. He didn't land. A doorbell camera from a nearby neighbor caught that. They, I guess, sent it off to the FAA. And Trent's in some trouble, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, that's different because he's doing what should be the right thing. And then, boy, maybe getting
right
for that. So that one's not so good.
But now he's we can't say too much about it, but we did have a story about it. We actually talked a little bit about it. I think Richard did on that analysis when he was talking about the Red Bull event. And just another reminder that if you are not, you should also consider joining AOPA and the Pilot Protection Services package in case you do run into any issues.
In case you need it, yes.
Yeah, right, right.
Absolutely. Yeah, good point. All right, let's quickly wrap up today with the news about Ehrenfriedrichshafen. So this just happened very recently. I think it was last week as we record this. This is the GA event over in Germany, and it is, if you've never been there, it's very technology-focused, forward-looking, a lot of lighter aircraft, because that's obviously what's popular in Europe. And so Tom Horn was there covering this for us and had some really interesting pieces come back. David, there's two things I'm particularly excited about, but tell me what, out of what he reported, what are you liking?
Well, you know, I'm interested in the Pipistrel setup there. You know, Textron recently bought into Pipistrel, and we're looking at a little bit more in the way of electric propulsion technology, and it seems like it's maturing a little bit more. That was interesting to me, and you and I talked off the show a little bit about hydrogen propulsion. And so I think from a technical standpoint, those two are neat. I think your eyes are somewhere else, though, in the aero world. Where are they, Ian?
Yeah, there are two things in particular. One is this Junkers. Well, there's a couple that they've put out, but there's a replica. They're calling it the Junkers A-50 Junior. This is an airplane from, maybe the 20s or 30s? Super cool-looking little airplane. This has a Rotax engine, MT prop, Garmin panel, so it's all modern. But it's got that Junkers traditional corrugated aluminum skin, this little torpedo-like fuselage, tandem open cockpit, low wing with the spoked wheels. I just think this is the coolest thing. I love it.
It's a neat-looking aircraft. And the whole design concept is pretty sexy. The two-hole, you know, fuselage, I mean, I get it. And that would be neat. Now, what's the price on something like that, Ian? Let's bring it down to brass tacks.
Yeah, that's important. The first 29, they're offering at €179,000, so including the VAT. So you don't have to pay the VAT. So, which I think...
Value-added tax.
Yeah, don't quote me on this, but I believe if you're going to buy it for export, I believe that they take that off. But of course, knowing that you're going to have to pay tax in the States. But yeah, so it says here, maiden flight February 1929 for the original A-50.
Wow, how about that?
Yeah, very cool stuff. I think I can't wait to see what that's going to be like when people fly it. The other thing, and I'm partly interested in this because I'm working on a story for the magazine, is small turbines. There was the Turbaro that came out of Sun and Fun.
Okay.
Some other people, like, you know, the Sonics are flying with small turbines. But the JMB, which is this really sexy looking LSA, they've put some kind of cool engines in airplanes. They are now putting in a little turbine, and it is the coolest little airplane.
Well, it sounds pretty neat on the video too. You hear the turbine whine of this thing crank up, and it is a slick low wing airplane, and it reminds me a little bit of a cross between a Lancer and maybe a Cirrus.
Yeah,
it's a pretty sexy little thing. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot too much for this, but I mean, how much would something like that cost with the turboprop?
Well, this is that's really the point, right? Is that these turbines are still really expensive, and so I think they're saying just the engine is $100,000.
Okay,
so that's, you know, you're talking about double or triple, probably triple the price of the current engine. But future fuel proof, so because you can always put jet fuel in it and everything else. They've flown this thing like 80 hours, so it's been out there flying around. Yeah,
the airframe itself also is similar to their Rotex powered airframe that they've had out for a while, so it's a proven design.
Yeah,
and that is something that we could probably get. Now, I wonder if we could bring that to the States. I know it's EASA certified, but is that something I wonder if we could bring that to the U.S. and fly around in that as a LSA?
Yeah, I mean,
certainly not with a turboprop.
Yeah, exactly, because LSAs have to have reciprocating. Mm-hmm. So, but we'll see in the next couple of years. Very cool stuff. And that's Friedrichshafen. Always has kind of neat stuff. Diamond announced a quick charge electric. I mean, so some really neat stuff I think that we're going to see over the next couple of years.
Absolutely. Well, we got to look forward to that for the future. And then, by the way, if any of this does come to pass, you can get it charged up over at
Airbnb. At Oshkosh. Yeah, right. That's right. All right, David. So from the future to the past, Erin Miller, really dynamic person that you met on this flight. She's just, you got to have such energy and such passion for these issues to be able to push them through like she has, and really excited to hear about how she was able to do that, some of the barriers she faced, and what she thinks the future of the WASPs are.
Welcome to the show, Aaron Miller. Thanks for being here with us. We are in Texas on location in Sweetwater for the Women Air Force Service Pilots annual gathering. And it's a little windy outside. Folks can maybe hear that on the audio. But I want to find out a little bit more about your story. How did you find out about your grandma's involvement in the WASPs?
So growing up, I always knew what she did. It wasn't a secret or anything. It's not like she sat around talking to us about it all the time or anything, but we knew about it. I have a picture, actually. I'm maybe 4 or 5 years old, and I have a t-shirt that said, "Gammy flew planes in World War II." So I always knew about it. I actually thought everyone's grandma was a pilot during World War II. I thought that's what grandmas did. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized, no, not everyone's grandma flew planes during World War II. So.
Well, let's introduce your grandma, Elaine Harmon, and tell us a little bit about what she did in World War II.
So Elaine Danforth Harmon was my grandmother, and she's from Baltimore, Maryland. There were 13 WASP from the state of Maryland. Mm-hmm. So during the war, she joined the Women Air Force Service Pilots, and she was in the second to last class. After training, she was stationed at Nellis Air Base, which today Nellis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And her duties were to train male pilots on instrument training in the BT-13. People who listen to your podcast probably know the BT-13 has two seats, one behind the other, and there's a canopy.
Mm-hmm.
So they would put a tarp in the canopy so you can't see out of it, and then you have to fly in the instruments. And my grandma would be in the other seat, kind of. She told me her job was to make sure they didn't crash into Mount Charleston.
That makes sense.
Is what she told me her job was.
Absolutely. She taught in that airplane. She taught in the PT-17?
BT-13.
BT-13.
Yes.
Boeing Stearman?
She trained on the Stearman.
That's what I was
But then
saying.
That was her favorite airplane.
Okay.
But when she was working, that was her job was on the BT-13.
Okay. So her job was on the BT-13. She trained in the PT-17.
Yes.
She also flew some B-17 Flying Fortresses.
Yes, she had some co-pilot time in the B-17, although she did tell me once that she was glad she never had to take over because she didn't know if she would remember how to fly it, and I was like, I'm sure you would have been fine. But yes, she did. When they were moving the planes around, she flew on them sometimes.
Well, Aaron, let's get back to the beginning. So now you're a child, I'm assuming, and you're hanging out with Grandma. How did you first learn of her involvement?
I genuinely don't remember not knowing that she did this. So I can't say that there was a day where it was like, oh, I knew, like, I always knew what she did. It was not something that I never knew about. So I can't really say that there's a day where it's like she sat down and told me what she did. It was always there.
Okay. Well, here we are in Sweetwater, Texas, and this is the home of the WASP Museum. You told me, and we met on a Southwest flight coming over here, which is pretty cool. You told me that this is a new facility. Part of the facility is new, and we're going to have a little bit of a big band celebration tonight. It's the 80th anniversary for the WASPs, and there's a whole new museum wing. There's a new gift shop. It's pretty interesting. There are a lot of cool new exhibits.
Yes. So over the last several years, they've been working really hard to fundraise and expand the museum from the old hangar, which we are sitting in right now. And even they've upgraded this hangar to these offices that we're in now, which is great. And then the new building hangar over there, which is all air conditioned, environmentally sound for all the exhibits. And they can do, you know, rotating displays and all kinds of things over there. And so, yeah, it's really a great facility. And they're trying to, you know, really honor the WASP and their legacy.
Well, let's get to that legacy because when I started at AOPA, it was in 2015, and I know that you have been fighting the fight to get the WASPs reinterred at Arlington National Cemetery. I know this was a tough deal because there was a lot of resistance. Can you walk us through that?
So my grandmother died in April 2015. And my grandmother had gone to many funerals of fellow WASP at Arlington National Cemetery. And she decided that is where she wanted to have her body laid to rest.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly because, A, we're from Maryland, so it's nearby. It's not like, but B, because millions of people visit that cemetery every year.
Mm-hmm.
And her thought process was people are walking around the cemetery like tourists. And they're learning about all these different people that have served our country, and they maybe see her gravesite and they see WASP and they're like, what's that? And then they Google it or something and they learn more about them. So she was kind of trying to think of her final resting place as a teaching moment, right? That was kind of the main deal.
Okay.
So my grandfather was a civilian. He's not laid to rest at Arlington. He's in a civilian cemetery. Mm-hmm. So she would have to be laid to rest there on her own merit, her own service as a WASP.
Okay.
During the 1970s, they had a fight to get a law passed to recognize them retroactively as veterans, because during the war, there was a bill in Congress that did not pass, and so they were never formally commissioned into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a law in 77, as I mentioned. There were other WASPs buried there, so we didn't really think this would be an issue. And after we submitted the paperwork, Arlington called my mom and told them that she was not eligible to be there on her own merit.
Hmm.
Because the law in 1977 was very specific to laws administered by the Veterans Administration.
Right.
And Arlington National Cemetery is run by the Department of the Army.
Gotcha.
So the other national military cemeteries are run by VA. So she could have been there, but she requested to be at Arlington National Cemetery. So per her wishes, we tried to make that happen. They rejected our application, so we contacted our senator at the time, and we, a few months later, got a letter back saying, you know, here's the information we received, and we wish this could have worked out better. It was four sentences.
Oh, my.
And I was like, this is not appropriate, so...
How did that make you feel at that time? Because you knew that she had dedicated a good year or so of her life to the Army and helping train other pilots.
At first, I was just mostly confused.
Uh-huh.
But then once we got the letter back mm-hmm. from our senator and from the cemetery explaining uh-huh. everything, uh-huh. Uh-huh. I actually got angry
uh-huh.
and irritated. And I felt bad for my grandma because it was really important to her that her service be recognized.
Sure.
And since the 1970s, she had spent a lot of time going around giving talks and lectures and, you know, doing news interviews and all of this to make sure that their history was preserved and their legacy was recognized
sure.
properly. And so being denied at Arlington, she would have been heartbroken to know that they were denying her last wish, essentially, after all this work that she and the other women have gone through for so long to just be recognized for their service. So I started this campaign on social media to have people be aware that this had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it gained a lot of momentum.
Yes.
And through that, more and more news people were contacting me, doing stories, and then eventually we got the attention of Congress. And so member of the House of Representatives, Martha McSally from Arizona uh-huh. at the time, was in the House. It was her first freshman session, right? Or freshman Congress, I should say. And she learned about this through the news with her staff, and she herself is a 26-year veteran of the Air Force, retired as a colonel. She was an A-10 pilot. And actually the first woman to fly combat missions for the Air Force after they lifted the restriction on women flying in combat in 1993.
Okay.
So she conveniently was in the House of Representatives and was, of course, very pumped to introduce this legislation and make sure that these women were properly recognized. So from that point forward, I spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill visiting with senators and members of the House. I met with more than 150 offices on Capitol Hill in person. And then obviously many more emailing and phone calls and things like
sure.
that to make sure they were supporting this legislation. And then eventually it was passed through the House unanimously and then went over to the Senate and was signed through the Senate and eventually signed by the President of the United States in May 2016. So we were able to go back to Arlington and say, well, we got this law passed that my grandmother is eligible from her own service
right.
to be laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. My grandmother was cremated, so her ashes were sitting in the closet at home this
Understood.
Whole time.
Now, Barack Obama was president at the time who signed that.
Barack Obama was president, yes, okay. at the time.
But now, this affected other folks besides just her, right?
Right. So the law...
It set a precedent.
Right. So the law in the 1970s that got passed allowed groups who felt that they had served during World War II or previously in a military capacity but were not properly recognized to petition the Department of Defense for retroactive recognition as veterans.
Okay.
So after the law got passed, they had to petition the Department of Defense, which took another 2 years. So essentially it took 35 years for my grandmother to receive her DD-214.
Wow. And she wasn't the only one.
No. So eventually there were roughly 37 other groups of people, the Filipino scouts, Northwest Airlines pilots, and eventually the merchant mariners of World War II lost more than 9,000 people that were killed. They actually had to go to court and fight this until, I think, 1989 to be recognized.
Okay.
So
But for the WASP, the fact was they were acting in a civilian capacity, I guess, and that was the hang-up, right?
So the confusion is that the idea was that they were flying Army planes, they were being trained by Army, you know, it was an Army thing, right?
Yes.
And when they joined, I mean, some of the WASPs have telegrams that say, like, if you don't want to join the Army, don't come here.
Oh, goodness.
So they were under the impression they were joining the Army.
Right.
And it was just going to take some time to get this bill passed in Congress.
Sure.
To formally commission them.
Okay.
And while that was going on, obviously they can't wait for the war, right? They need to, you know, the war goes on regardless of what Congress does.
Right.
So they were under the impression they're going to go train, go work on these planes, fly these planes, whatever, and eventually this bill would get passed and everything would be normal. But it didn't happen. So the program was disbanded on December 20th, 1944, and the bill never got passed, so they never became formally recognized as being part of the Army. 38 of them died during service, and even that they were not recognized for.
Well, some probably died during training.
Yes.
Of course. Because
mm-hmm.
this was dangerous stuff back in the
right.
day. I mean, think about World War II. That was in the 1940s. The airplanes had only been around for 40 years,
right.
you know. And there was a lot to still be determined on how to, you know, operate within the envelope and that kind of thing. Plus, it just happens to be dangerous. I mean, you're teaching
right.
other pilots how to fly.
Exactly. Yeah, and like you said, exactly. It's dangerous stuff. You're training planes. You know, some of these planes are new, or they're being repaired, or what have
right.
you with these planes. So, you know, you don't know the condition of them, and, you know.
And the women Air Force service pilots, a lot of their mission was similar to your grandma's. They would ferry airplanes around the country
yes.
part of the time.
Yes.
They would train other aviators part of the time
yes.
as well. And
there were a lot of different tasks that they did. So,
okay.
yes, they trained other aviators. They ferried aircraft. So the aircraft would go through the factory. Rosie the Riveter would be building it. It
yeah.
would pop out the end. A WASP would hop in, and then they would fly it to wherever it needed to go. They also towed targets for anti-aircraft fire, so like a banner behind the plane. Kind of
okay.
like at the beach, you see those beer ads,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So they towed kind of a banner, and the guys would learn to shoot at this banner. So they flew this banner. That was their part of their mission.
I would think that might be a little dangerous if the shots were off target a little bit.
Yeah, it was dangerous. Ironically, none of the women died doing that
okay.
job specifically.
Okay. Okay.
Although I'm sure some of them came quite close. Nell Bright, I think, says something like, well, they didn't always hit the target, but luckily they didn't hit me, or something like that.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's one of the more like dramatic jobs. And you know, a lot of it was very routine flying, like breaking in engines, you know, just flying, getting hours on the engine, that kind of thing.
And let's not forget, they were 19, 20, 21 years old.
Yes, they were young people. You know, my grandma was 25 at the time.
Now she learned to fly as part of the, it was the prior to the FAA, it was the CAA.
Right.
And she learned to fly. Did she learn to fly in College Park in Maryland, in that area?
Yes. So
okay.
my grandmother went to the University of Maryland in College Park. And at the time, the civilian pilot training program was part, you know, coordinating with, that was one of the universities they coordinated
yeah.
with. So during college, her last year of college, there was an advertisement in the newspaper, the school newspaper, about the civilian pilot training program, which cost $40 and included 35 hours of ground school, I believe, and then flight hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost $40, so she asked her dad for the money because her mother was very traditional, and my grandmother knew she wouldn't approve of her doing unladylike things like flying an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But her dad was very supportive, gave her the money, signed her permission slip because she was under 21 and not married
okay.
and female, so she
okay.
had to get permission to do this program. They only let one woman for every 10 men in the program, so she got in. I don't know if it was, you know, if lots of women were trying to get in, or she just happened to do it and nobody else wanted to, so I'm not really sure about that, but she got in anyway and got her pilot's license through that program at College Park Airport.
Well, that's a historical airport also in and of itself.
It is a historical airport. It's the oldest continuously operating airport in the United States.
If not the world, right. We're still, the jury's out
yeah.
on that, but you said it was within a couple of days.
Yeah.
Yeah, understood,
so, yes.
understood. Well, that's interesting. It is a historical airport. There is also, bringing it back to the WASPs, your grandma has some of her flight suit and other things that she used on display there, right?
Right, the College Park Aviation Museum has, my grandmother donated a lot of her things there. She, you know, used to give talks there and things. And her uniform is there, her congressional gold medal, her logbook.
Okay.
A bunch of stuff. I mean, obviously some of it's in the back, but on display they have things for her funeral and, yeah, a lot of her items are there.
What does it make you feel like when you come into that little airport, and you were there for the Latinas in Aviation Day last year? What's it make you feel like when you see these items?
Well, it's really a tribute to my grandmother, and I'm glad that there is an entity taking care of her things and preserving history so other people can learn about what she did.
Mm-hmm.
She was not a boastful person, but I think she understood that what she did was important and was a stepping stone for other women and other people, you know, who were closed out from aviation, or not just aviation, but other, you know, industries because of whatever characteristic they had. So it was important to her to have that preserved and legacy, a way for people to learn. But it is pretty cool to be in the museum and there's people walking around and they see the things and I say, oh, that was my grandma's stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are like, wow, that's so cool.
Absolutely. And then we're here at the 80th reunion and a lot of folks know you. They've stopped you while we were doing our interviews. They stopped you in the hallways and stuff. What's that feel like?
I mean, it's cool that people know me, but, you know, it's more cool that they know why they know me, you know, because leading this campaign at Arlington and making sure that my grandmother and all the other women Air Force Service pilots were properly recognized for their contributions and service during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the people here are family members of other WASP. And even if their family member chose not to be at Arlington, you know, it's still the principle of being recognized as equal to the other people that you served with who did the same job.
They at least have the opportunity.
Right, they have the opportunity.
How many years did that take, the whole campaign?
So from the time my grandmother passed away until we had a funeral was almost a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
In between that, we went to Congress and got this law passed. And, you know, by Washington standards, it was pretty quick.
It was.
So it was, you know, we were very lucky. And I try to explain that in my book that, you know, yes, I worked very hard and my family worked. We had all these people supporting us. But we were also very lucky with all these different people who happened to be around helping us and media people and Congress. You know, it was kind of a good mix of people helping us.
Tell me about the books that you have. You have two books now at this point, because I saw one on the Southwest commercial flight that we sat next to each other on. Tell us about the first book first.
So my first book I wrote was Final Flight, Final Fight, which I have here.
Yeah.
And that chronicles the campaign to get this law passed for Arlington, but I also explain it through my relationship with my grandmother, why it was important to her to to have this done so people understand why we were working so hard for this and we weren't just like, oh, we can just bury her somewhere else, right? It was important to her to be recognized. And I also explain the process of going to Congress, you know, talking to the senators and the members of the House of Representatives and working with the media and working with the public support. And, you know, most people in the country will, you know, never go to Washington and have to talk to a member of Congress to get something done. And sometimes I think it can seem like a very abstract concept, you know, this faraway people that do things, you know, and so I try to bring people into that, like, how, you know, you're doing that's kind of our country's design, right? Going to the government and getting your
you have your say.
Your problem resolved.
You want to be heard.
Right. Being heard, having someone resolve your problem, having legislation passed to fix your issue. So I try to explain all of that in the book, you know, and obviously the history of the WASP.
Sure.
So I kind of weave it all together in one story, kind of through the story of getting this done at Congress.
And give us the name of the book one more time.
Final Flight, Final Fight.
Final Flight, Final Fight. And how can folks get the book?
So the book is available on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, you know, whatever online retailer. It's on sale. Well, it was on sale at the College Park Aviation Museum. The WASP Museum has copies.
Okay.
Yeah, but some museums around the country have copies.
Final Flight, Final Fight.
Yes.
Very good. Now, you wrote a children's book.
Yes.
And it's illustrated by a family member.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I wrote a children's book as well, and I asked my cousin Randall Harmon, who is an artist, to do the designs, and she was very excited to do that.
Yeah.
So she did these beautiful paintings, and we digitized them and created a children's book. And it's basically the same story, but for little kids learning to read or parents reading to their children, like age 4 to 6 or younger if parents are reading to them. Just basically the same story, you know, a girl learning about what her grandma did in World War II and how it was important to be recognized for their service and going to Congress. And
though it takes the concept of the WASPs and it kind of personalizes it, but it's told in such a way that young people could understand it.
Exactly. So the story is, it's not me, it's a young girl mm-hmm. and a grandma who was a WASP. Obviously sure. It's based on my grandmother, but it's not specifically her, and I kind of just talk about this young girl being at home and learning from her grandma, telling her stories.
Now, you confided in me one thing that I'm going to put you on the spot for. You said you were very interested at one point in becoming an astronaut.
Yes.
Now, I know you're too busy to fly right now, but tell me about that whole concept of trying to become an astronaut. What were you thinking? About what age were you?
That's another thing. I was just kind of always interested in it, and my grandmother, from a very young age, would take me and my cousins to air shows, and she paid to have me fly up in an old airplane once and a helicopter, and I was always interested in it. I remember she gave me a biography of Jackie Cochran once, and I think I read it when I was like 8 years old, so it's okay. Kind of funny. But it was one of those things I was just always interested in. You know, growing up in my period of childhood, the space shuttle was a huge thing.
Sure.
You know, and every time the space shuttle went off, it was on the news and everyone talked about it, and I thought it was so cool. So that was something I was really interested in, you know, was the space program. And I had all the patches, and I knew all of the different, all the different, like, Apollo, Gemini, Mercury programs, and the space shuttle, and I went to space camp twice, and I was, like, very into it.
That is awesome. Now, you told me also that you would love to learn how to fly, get your pilot certificate, but you're actually so busy being an advocate for other folks, especially young people now. There's a little bit of young people news that you could break with us today, too.
Yeah, so I am busy. I have a normal job that is unrelated to aviation, but is related to veterans. But, you know, I'm so busy doing this. People are really interested in hearing about the WASP, and I think they like hearing it from a family member with a personal connection who can explain why it's important to remember history and fight for recognition. Mm-hmm. And so I've met all of these aviation people, and part of my grandma's interest in aviation was keeping history alive. You know, that's why her stuff's in the museum. Mm-hmm. And she loved old airplanes, and she would fly in the Stearmans, and anyone that would offer her a ride, she always went up. But part of history, living history, is also the aircraft they flew.
Sure.
So I am starting a scholarship through the Women in Aviation International Scholarship Organization Program, uh-huh. I'll say that. Two scholarships, one for learning to do, having your tail dragger certificate.
Okay.
And then the other one will be up to $5,000 to do your certification in a World War II era airplane.
To keep history alive.
To keep history alive. Because okay. Obviously, a lot of pilots, learning to fly is expensive, first of all. But mm-hmm. It seems that most people, you know, if you're doing general aviation, that's cool. But a lot of people are going through it to get a job, to become a pilot, a corporate pilot, a commercial pilot, whatever, to get paid to do it.
Sure.
So most of the people that are keeping warbirds flying, you know, whether it's the pilots, the mechanics, people, they're volunteering.
It's a private enterprise generally.
Yes, it's private enterprise. It's people volunteering. It's their free time. You know, they are spending their own money doing this.
Hundreds of dollars per hour.
Hundreds of dollars, hundreds of hours of their time.
Absolutely.
To keep these planes flying. And they're important pieces of history because it's just different when you go to an airfield and you see the plane turn on and you smell the gasoline and you hear the noises.
See the
and
smoke.
See the smoke right. And you can, you know, touch the airplane. Yeah. And this is a plane that actually was around during World War II, and a lot of them actually, you know, flew in missions, and it's just different to actually be able to get in those planes or touch them or even be around them, you know. I mean, it's awesome to see them in a museum and a static display, but it's different to actually see them functioning and like how they move. And, you know, sometimes you can even be lucky enough to get it right in them.
Sure. So one scholarship is $5,000 to learn how to get involved in and fly a warbird.
Yes.
And the other scholarship, $1,500 to learn how to,
to get a tail wheel endorsement. Yes, tail wheel endorsement.
Because that also is, most of the airplanes, you know, up till World War II were tail dragger airplanes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the first step is kind of getting your tail wheel certification and then going on and learning, you know, certification in one of the various old World War II era airplanes.
Fantastic.
Whichever one you may be interested in.
That's excellent. Kudos to you. Now, do you know how folks could get involved with that or should they just join Women in Aviation International, or how will
So in order to apply for the scholarship, you can join Women in Aviation International.
Okay.
The scholarship program for this coming year's cycle will come out July 1st, this summer.
Great.
And then the scholarships are presented next year at the conference.
And that's usually in the spring.
Yes, yes. It will be February next year in Long Beach, California, I believe.
Okay.
So they announced the scholarships there.
And the Women in Aviation International, I mean, they give out hundreds of thousands of dollars for the scholarship.
Yeah, I think this year they gave around $500,000 of scholarships.
That's fantastic. So. Now, AAPA also does scholarships. We gave out 80 scholarships to high school students last year and 20 to teachers. So about $1 million worth of scholarships, a little bit over that.
Wow.
But there are many ways to get involved in aviation, scholarships being one. Now, what would you say to young people that want to get involved in aviation?
So obviously there are a lot of different facets of aviation, right? There's becoming a pilot, becoming a mechanic, all kinds of different things. Obviously, I think the first thing, just do your research, find some books on that topic, but you can also, there's a lot of opportunities going to museums, going to aviation events, fly-ins, you know, and just go up and talk to some of these people. And I think aviation folks in general are very open and excited to share their knowledge and their network with people. And you know, those type of people, depending on what pathway you're kind of interested in, those people kind of explain how they got there and kind of explain the best path for whatever that person might be interested in.
That sounds good. Again, I want to apologize to our listeners. Mm-hmm. They might hear doors opening and closing and a little bit of background noise. We're at the WASP's 80th anniversary celebration.
The program. Yeah, so it started in 1942, mm-hmm. So it's 2022, so 80 years.
Mm-hmm. And so folks are coming and going, and there's going to be a big band later tonight. We're going to hear some speeches from some dignitaries. Tomorrow there's going to be a fly-in. We're looking at possibly having 80 airplanes or more here. There are a lot of military aircraft already on the field here in Sweetwater, and the name of the field is Avenger Field.
Yes, Avenger Field out here in Sweetwater, Texas. Yeah, tomorrow we're going to have a C-130 fly-in, and the pilot will be one of the WASP granddaughters.
Oh, great.
Tana Gilpatrick, so that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to have a bunch of warbirds, maybe up to like 40 old warbirds, different kinds, including BT-13s.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of warbirds, a cool old fly-in. Yeah.
Well, Aaron, we appreciate your time with us today and also your passion and compassion for keeping history alive.
I appreciate you taking the time to share this information and story and help keep the not only the Women Air Force Service history, like pilots history alive, but you know, warbirds and you know, all of that history.
Well, we appreciate you fighting the good fight. Final flight, final fight,
yes.
That helped get a WASP reinterred at Arlington National Cemetery, and that was quite a big fight. Like I said, I was at AOPA in the e-media department when that was going on, and I remember how big of a deal that was. And so kudos to you for not giving up.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate AOPA's support and all the support of all the different organizations that had their members kind of email their congress people and stuff, because it does help. It seems kind of like, who am I? I'm calling this person and it's not important. But when you go into the office and there's, you know, they've been like, we've gotten tons of phone calls about this, it makes them, you know, pay attention. So it is helpful.
Yet another reason to be an AOPA member. I'd say to throw that in at the last minute. All right, Aaron Miller, thanks again for helping us out. We appreciate your time today. Your mom is here, I know, and you have things to do. So hopefully we'll see each other again in the skies.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
So, David, the event, I think there was one living WASP who attended, is that right?
Absolutely, and she's 99 years old. I got a chance to meet Shirley Krause. She's a nice woman. She greeted a lot of folks. And listen, Ian, they had a pretty bodacious-looking fly-in going on there where they had, you know, 80 or more airplanes that flew in, several warbirds over there in Sweetwater, Texas. Now, Sweetwater is a destination that you kind of got to want to go there, and that's where the WASP Museum is. That's why it was there. But on Friday night, they had a nice little gala get-together to help fund that museum and some of its future exhibits, and they have a great little museum, I must admit. And the folks there were just so gung-ho about aviation, and there was a lot of diversity, something we need more of in aviation, like Aaron said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a great event. I was glad to be part of it, just covering it.
All right, fantastic. So that's all the time we have for this week. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hanson.
I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangertalk and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Hanger Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.